Blog Talk Radio.
Stop wasting time with Mr. Wrong and decide to prepare yourself to find Mr. Right. Mr. Wrong will never be Mr. Right. Now is the time to say goodbye to Mr. Wrong right now. Get out of the singles bars and off the internet, because Mr. Right is waiting for you on your own personal divine path. Mr. Right wants to get married as much as you do. Mr. Right wants everything you want. Devoted love, acceptance, appreciation, honesty, validation, and faithfulness. So get ready to find Mr. Right. Join wedding officiant Reverend Marcy Ann as she shares with you her 20 years of experience meeting with thousands of brides and grooms and hearing their love stories of what works and what doesn't work. Every week, Reverend Marcy Ann will be expanding on the ideas and principles that she has written about in her book, 17 Things to Do While Waiting for Mr. Right, which is available at www.MrRightForMe.com and at Amazon.com. And now, here is Marcy Ann.
And hello to all of you singles out there. This is Marcy Ann, and as the announcer said, the title of my book is 17 Things to Do While Waiting for Mr. Right, because the waiting, you know, the waiting time can kind of be painful. So during that waiting time is when you are preparing yourself to be Miss Right. And once you become Miss Right, then Mr. Right will find you. And one of the questions I ask in my book on page 45 on the private personal worksheet is, what is your service to God? That's question 6. And then question 8 is, what is your spiritual expectation of yourself? So while I was waiting, I needed to have some things to do. And my book is semi-autobiographical because these 17 things I write about are what I did while I was waiting and preparing myself to be Miss Right. And they may not be things that you want to do. In fact, probably most of them won't even appeal to you at all. Like writing the Bible 5 times from Genesis 1:1 to Revelation 22:21. But one of those questions is, what is my service to God? What is my spiritual expectation of myself? Well, I actually started out writing the Bible just to fill time. Just to fill the time rather than, you know, sitting around and moping and feeling sorry for myself because I was Friday night and I didn't have a date. I just bought some pretty books with blank pages in them, and I bought a whole bunch of different kinds of pens and different colors, and I just started copying the Bible. I tried all different kinds of writing, you know, backhand, and then trying to perfectly make every single letter exactly the same height and width as every other letter. And actually, it turned out that it was, you know, more an exercise in art than it was any attempt to learn anything. But, you know, long about the third time through, I began to realize I was learning things. Kind of subliminally, you know. And then one day as I was writing with a green pen on this pretty page in my notebook that had a pretty border all around the lines on the blank page, I wrote, God hates the putting forth of the finger. Say what? I went back and looked at that verse. I thought, is that what that actually says? You know, the verse was Isaiah 58:9. Now, first of all, this was thousands of years ago, and here it said, God hates the putting forth of the finger. To myself, if God hated the putting forth of the finger way back then, he must really be teed off today. How many times in our society today do people put forth that third finger and say, F you? I mean, even traditional Bible commentary today says the putting forth of the finger is to disdainfully insult. So apparently people have been doing this for a long, 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 long time. And the Bible says that God doesn't like it. God doesn't like for people to disdainfully insult anyone. Boy, you know what? That would just about do away with all television and movies today, wouldn't it? Disdainful insults are a judgment that we make. I think sometimes we're just trying to be funny. But you know what? These insults hurt other people. And that's the one thing that we as humans do not have the right to do, and that's to hurt or harm someone else. And that's why God doesn't like it. That's why we don't like it. So if you don't want to have disdainful insults thrown at you, don't throw them to anybody else. Try to always compliment or encourage. If you can't, then just don't say anything. My mother always said that you could tell a person's intelligence by what they said. So let your speech reflect that you're a kind and caring, intelligent, and consciously aware person. So this would be part of what my spiritual expectation would be of myself. To be a kind and caring, intelligent, and consciously aware person, and never put forth the finger to anyone. Well, another thing I learned from writing the Bible five times is that everything's in the Bible. And throughout the course of my lifetime, I have looked into just about everything. When I first moved to San Diego in 1986, freshly single and ready to just be Marcy Ann, no more Mrs. Anybody, I realized that I was in the heart of the New Age movement, and I just began to go to everything, conferences on aliens and UFOs, and Area 51, and conferences on starseed people and the genetics of the earth, and I went to past life meditations. I did rebirthing. I called upon the angels. I went to all kinds of health practices like iridology, where the doctor looks at the iris in your eye and can tell what's wrong with you, and laid on massage tables with drums inside of them, and the percussion stimulated my body to operate in a higher vibration. And then reflexology, where a facilitator massages every organ of the body by pushing on certain places on the bottom of your feet. I went to toning circles where we used our voices to harmonize our bodies, and I became a tuning fork facilitator. I went to every esoteric type of meeting I could find, Scientology, Wicca, shamanism, Unitarian, New Thought, writings of Ernest Holmes, Alice Bailey, Madame Blavatsky. I studied the Torah, and I took the Jewish study of the Talmud and the six orders of the Mishnah and the Kabbalah, which is about the Jewish tree of life. And I took classes in ancient history and mythology, and I read stories of the ancient past. I mean back to like around 10,000 BC. And I discovered these were familiar stories, stories that are also in the Bible. And then as I wrote the Bible, I realized that everything I had studied, everything I had found out about was all in the Bible. It's all in there. So I guess that's why the Bible continues to be the best-selling book in the world, because it really is an encyclopedia of world truth and history. So if you want to know anything about anything, read the Bible. It's all in there. And another thing that happened is I wrote the Bible five times. I began to realize that, and I found out that everything is in the Bible. I began to find myself being set free from religious teachings, because I learned that there's spiritual truth and then there is religious teaching. And it's the religious teachings of the men who run the different religions on the earth that have caused all the trouble between us. I mean, religion has done more to divide and separate people than anything else. Now, I believe the men who run these religions were originally well-intentioned at the beginning of the major religions, you know, starting with the oldest, the Sumerians, and then Taoism, the teachings of Confucius, Hinduism, Zoroastrianism, Buddhism, then the Jews, the Catholics, the Christians, the Muslims, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Mormons, and more recently, Ron Hubbard's Scientology. But organizations have to have places for people to come to learn about the religion, and they begin to own land and build buildings and pay taxes, and all of this takes money, and someone has to be in charge of the money and decide hours and times and what to teach and how to teach it. And then men are born, and then a man dies, and a new person comes in and is in charge. He wants to put his spin on things. And as the time goes by, the organization gets caught up in a storm that the Bible calls every wind of doctrine. You know what? Now, why am I going on and on about this on a show that's supposed to be helping you find Mr. Right? That's the question tonight. Why is it important enough to devote a whole show on finding Mr. Right? What place does spiritual truth and religious teachings have in whether you can find Mr. Right or not? So, what place does spiritual truth or religious teaching have in your current life? So question number four on the personal private worksheet is, what is the desire for your soul's fulfillment? Question five, what is your purpose in life? Question six, what is your service to God? Question seven, what is your service to man? Question eight, what is your spiritual expectation of yourself? Question nine, what is your material expectation of yourself? Number 10, what do you strive for as your mark of mastery? And question 11, what do you wish to leave on earth as your record of victory? Well, I have a friend in the U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary who's Catholic, and I asked her, does Mr. Right have to be a Catholic? And she said, absolutely, yes. And the truth is, whether you believe it or not, you are a product of whatever religious teaching you have had or have not had in your life. And even if you've already thrown the baby out with the bathwater, most of my brides and grooms today say, we are not religious, but we believe in God. Well, Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, Catholics, Christians, Muslims, and Mormons all believe in God. There's just one God and one creation. And we all came from the same place. Let there be light. But even if you haven't had any exposure to anything, any spiritual or religious teaching, just being a citizen of the United States puts you within a social justice system that's based on Roman law under the Catholic Church at Rome and Protestant Christian religious teachings from the Church of England. Because this country started out as a Christian nation with total belief in God as the source of the pure idea and intent of our forefathers. And their desire was to provide a place where people could live their lives in religious freedom and justice for all, and the right to live their lives in liberty in the pursuit of happiness. And this was to be an individual pursuit, each person free to be and become whatever their efforts of pursuit would lead them to, by the grace of God Almighty. And then understood within the boundaries of this type of freedom is the indisputable law that our liberty cannot harm another's liberty. So that is the golden rule. You know, Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself, thereby setting up this golden rule to never do to someone else what you wouldn't want to have done to you. And did you know that, curiously, all of the major religions of the earth have this golden rule? And perhaps in considering your own spiritual expectation for yourself, you could adopt the golden rule. Because Hinduism says, this is the sum of duty. Do not unto others which would cause you pain if done to you. Buddhism says, hurt not others in ways that you yourself would find hurtful. Confucianism says, surely it is the maxim of loving kindness. Do not do unto others what you would not have them do unto you. The Tao says, regard your neighbor's gain as your own gain, and your neighbor's loss as your own loss. Zoroastrianism says, that nature alone is good, which refrains from doing unto another whatsoever is not good for itself. And Judaism says, what is hateful to you, do not to your fellow man. Muslims say, no one of you is a believer until he desires for his brother that which he desires for himself. And then Christianity says, all things whatsoever you would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them. For this is the entire law and the prophets. So, okay, again, what does this have to do with finding Mr. Right? Well, if you're a single woman looking to find Mr. Right today, you're in a very different type of culture today than has been available to women in the past. Because women today have morphed into a creature that's never been seen on the earth before. Now, women started out, beginning in the ancient philosophies and religions of the earth, as the supreme goddess of the earth, the womb of creation, the nurturer of the human race, and the mother of the man. And in those ancient civilizations, the temples, or churches, if you would, were built in honor and respect to the woman. And those who went to the temple went there to worship and adore the woman as the womb of creation, as the nurturer of the human race, the face of the deep. Man bowed down and worshiped her. He knelt at her feet. He lays in her arms to be comforted and restored. He sucked her breasts. He gave her his seed. And down through the millennium and the centuries of time, women continued to be the man's comfort. The woman was the mother of his children, and the woman set and held the boundaries of a culture's integrity and its morality. The woman held the reins of the society's horses. She bestowed the prize to the winner. The woman nurtured the male children and taught them to be the kings of the earth. And the woman nurtured the female children and taught them to comfort the kings of the earth. The woman was the creator of all activities, in charge of all activities, the center of all activities within the king's kingdom. And she ruled with an iron fist, and she comforted with a loving touch. Well, then along came Paul in the New Testament. Now, what most people don't know about Paul, he was the one that had the thorn in the flesh, remember? And he complains and complains and prays and prays and prays to the Lord to take it away from him. And the Lord didn't take it away from him. But that thorn in Paul's flesh was his ex-wife. Now, Paul was a Pharisee. In fact, the Bible says Paul was a Pharisee of the Pharisees, meaning he was a first-class Pharisee. He was a learned and devout Jew. Well, to be a Pharisee, you had to be married. So Paul was married. But when Paul had his road to Damascus experience, where supposedly Jesus appeared to him in a human form and called him to follow his teachings and to leave the Jewish teachings, and Paul chose to become a Christian, Paul's wife was furious because she had a high position in the Jewish culture being the wife of a Pharisee. She had privilege and position. And when Paul quit and became an itinerant preacher living off of offerings and donations, she left him. And from then on, she sent members of her family and even hired professional protesters to go to his meetings and cause commotion and trouble. Don't listen to him. He's a heretic. He's defected. He's caused shame. And the abomination has come upon our family. And Paul would just pray and plead to God, oh, please make her stay away. Please stop these protests, God. And God's answer was, my grace is sufficient for you, Paul. You can take this. She's really helping you. She's calling attention to you. She's causing more people to come and see what it's all about than you realize. Because people are curious. The commotion gets people's attention. But I don't think Paul ever acquiesced to this answer, because he also had been used to his position and honor within the Jewish community, and now he was a scab. He was an insult. He was a disdainful insult. And the people were putting out the finger to him. I think he continued to be frustrated and became very bitter. And at one point, in his early frustrations, he wrote to the men, I don't want you to burn in your sexual lust, so I guess you'll just have to get married. But boy, for me, it would have been better if I had never been married. And then later on in his bitterness, he wrote that the women should submit themselves to their husbands. And, of course, the early Christian church continued the Jewish practices of the woman sitting on one side and the men sitting on the other. And so Paul told the women to be silent when they were in church. And you talk to your husband after you get home about anything you need to know about. And then a woman was never to teach a man. So there it is. There's the foundation of the Pauline theologies, as they are called. And that's when women began to be put down, put her under the feet of her husband, make her be silent and submit. And this status of the woman after 2014 years now is deep within our actual cellular biology. I'm sorry, but it's there. And even though later on in his writings, Paul did say there was no male or female in the spirit, and he altered the idea of submission from just the women submitting to the men, and then he said the true submission was for each one to submit one to the other in the love of God. However, this softer version of the Pauline theology is usually never preached from the pulpits, because the men found out they liked being the lord over the woman. And since all the priests in the Catholic Church are men, and just as an aside here, I don't know if you know it or not, but the Catholic Church teaches that Peter was the first pope. And by the way, Peter was married. And then most Protestant preachers in the early Christian church were men. So the Pauline theology has been preached for 2,014 years, and women all over the world now have mostly been treated like second-class citizens in every culture and society on the earth. So I remember when I first studied Hinduism, and I found that there was a huge part inside of me that was so thirsty for the teachings on the female in any kind of inspirational literature that I just couldn't get enough of studying about these Hindu goddesses in Hinduism. Now, the supreme reality, Brahman, is the original spirit. Hinduism says spirit manifests in both male and female form. You know, spirit is energy, and it manifests in both male and female form. And every major god has a goddess counterpart or consort. Now, even in the Chinese yin-yang duality, there is a feminine side. It's somewhat passive. But in Hinduism, the feminine is highly active. In fact, the word for goddess is Shakti, and it means power or energy. So Shakti is the great goddess, is the masculine aspect of spirit, and this feminine aspect of the divine takes more than one form. Well, of course it does. Every single one of us women is a form of this divine goddess. So let's look at some of these goddesses, because I believe that in this breakdown we can find where we are, which one of these fits us the most, that would give us a spiritual expectation of ourselves and have us know what our primary service to God and to man could be. So, the most ancient goddess is Sarasvati. Now, she's the Hindu muse who is the inspiration for all music, poetry, drama, and science. And musicians would pray to her before performing, and students would pray to her before they had to take a test. And she's fair-skinned and dressed in white to symbolize pure illumination. And she rides on a swan. She has four hands because in one she holds a book, in another she holds prayer beads because she's the source of all spiritual knowledge. And her other two hands hold a sitar, musical instrument. So there's an area of service to God and service to man as a goddess. Now the next one is the gentle goddess of health, of wealth, and prosperity, Lakshmi. Now, she's a very popular goddess because she provides not only material wealth, but also good health and a joyful family life. And she sits on a milky ocean seated on a lotus blossom, and she holds the blossom in her hand. She is very full-breasted and broad-hipped, and she has a kind smile on her face. And she wears a red dress, and coins, golden coins, rain down out of her two hands. And she's often shown seated with two elephants and a white owl. Now, her male counterpart is Vishnu, and Vishnu kind of metes out punishment, but Lakshmi is kind, and she always intercedes with Vishnu on behalf of the people. And in this role, she can be compared to, you know, the Virgin Mary, although Mary is a saint, not a goddess, but she is believed to ask Jesus to go easy on his devotees. So according to Hindu mythology, Vishnu has been in human form 10 times. And in every single one of his physical incarnations, his wife, Lakshmi, was with him. And their love stories of this divine couple are some among the most beloved tales in Hinduism. Okay, so if you have a bent towards wealth and health and prosperity, and then you could be this type of, provide this kind of service to God and to man. Okay, so there is Durga. She's a warrior goddess. And she battles evil. And so, let's see, the next one is Kali, and in Kali also battled evil, and she helped Durga one time when he was trying to defeat a very, very, very strong demon, and he couldn't do it, and every time he struck at the demon, there were drops of blood that would fall to the ground, and every drop of blood formed another demon. And so Durga was getting very frustrated and actually getting scared that he wasn't going to be able to beat this demon. So Kali just went and stuck out her tongue and caught all the drops of blood, and then she ended up just eating the demon. And she's known for her very no-nonsense way of eradicating negative thoughts and bad habits in the minds of her followers. So you can call upon Kali to fight for you and to slay the demons, because as the black one, she symbolizes the deep, that vast, unbounded, unknown counterpart of God, the womb of the Creator, where the words, "Let there be light," were spoken and seated in her womb. She is the mother of all there is. Now, when I was studying the Dzogchen Buddhism, I learned how to do a beautiful meditation to Vajrasattva. Now, in Buddhism, in the Dzogchen Buddhism, Vajrasattva is the name of the representation of the god of all there is. So like in Hinduism, he's called Brahman. In the Dzogchen Buddhism, it's Vajrasattva. And in this meditation, he is in union with his divine feminine counterpart and twin flame, and they are making love. And the juices of their lovemaking are flowing out to the earth and covering the earth with their love and healing the earth and everyone on the earth with the essence of their union in true love and devotion and respect and honor as they cherish one another. And after the earth and all who are on the earth are healed and their hearts are once again ready for true love, then the leftover juices go to the underworlds where even the hungry ghosts and the demons and the devils get to have a drop of love for their parched and tormented souls. Now, this meditation was in Sanskrit, which is the oldest language on the earth, and it was difficult to learn. But during the time that I did this mantra, I felt such a sense of fullness of being a woman like I had never felt before in my experience as a Christian. I felt the actual power and position of actually being one with Vajrasattva, who was the God in action, God in manifestation, God in power, God by direction, God in consciousness. And I felt myself sitting on that throne of God, high above all principalities and powers of the earth, above and over all the evil in high places, safe in the arms of God Almighty, in union with all of the powers and sovereign rights as his wife, the bride of Christ. And our love together was the source of all healing, all power for the highest and best good for the earth and everything and everybody on the earth. And the juices of our love were poured forth to love and protect and defend and nourish and restore. And even the realms of the dark places, the realms of hatred and the realms of the demons and the devil and kingdoms of the darkness and evil got to taste and feel our love. I did this meditation every day for 7 days with 125 people. And it was one of the most remarkable and self-empowering times in my life. And I went home from that retreat in a calm knowing that from then on, I was woman. I was the supreme divine goddess. And I was loved totally and completely by God. I had developed a place within myself where I stored all of this love while I was doing that meditation, when I knew I was one with God and our blessing was blessing the earth. And later I learned that this place within myself that had been empty and was longing for this love was my heart. And I then remembered that early in the retreat, we had done a loving kindness meditation. We were to visualize someone that we knew loved us standing in front of us. And then the facilitator went on with, you know, da-da-da-da-da, but I just didn't hear another word he said because I couldn't think of anybody who loved me that I could visualize to stand in front of me. I thought of my mother, but I had never really felt any love from my mother, not the kind of love that I wanted and needed. It's not that she wasn't a good mother, but she was very selfish, always thinking of herself first. And she mostly saw us kids as her servants to do what she didn't want to do. And she never complimented us or told us that we did anything right. She would always point out the one thing that we didn't do right. And I tried and tried to get her to tell me I had done a good job. I tried and tried and tried. But she would always find something that wasn't right and that I could do it better if I really tried. I just finally gave up trying to please her, and I just determined to get out of the house as soon as possible. And when I left home to go to college, I never came back. I found a husband, and I got married. But you know what? That's not a good reason to get married. Just to get away from home. Well, in those days, it wasn't as hard to get a guy to get married because marriage was the only way a man could depend on having regular sex when he needed it. Now, today, a man doesn't have to get married to get sex, so he just isn't as easy to get to the altar. But in my day, it was acceptable to have sex within marriage, so men got married. So I found a husband, and I got married. And I chose a man who was going to go to law school because I thought he'd make a lot of money. And I worked during the first 2 years of his law school to pay all the bills. And then he went to work in his law practice, and I began our family. But at the loving kindness meditation, I couldn't think of anyone in my life that I felt really had ever loved me. My mother loved me to the extent she understood mother love, but she didn't have a mother. Her mother died in childbirth, and she was raised by her dad, so she really didn't know what the love of a mother was. And then my father had left my mother when he found out that she was pregnant. And as a baby, I was just passed between my mother and my aunt and my grandmother's houses. And then when I was 2 1/2, mother married again and had 3 more children. And then I just became the mother, in a sense, to all the new kids, because mother pretty much had put me in charge of them by the time I was 6 years old. So as I searched my memory for some sort of love that I had felt as a child, I decided to pick my Aunt Cecil. She was my stepfather's sister, and she had never married, and she had sort of adopted all of her nieces and nephews as her children. And she never forgot our birthday, and I could remember getting hugs from her and getting to sit on her lap and having her really listen to me and seem to be interested in me personally when we would go to her house to visit. So I began to visualize her standing in front of me. But by the time I was able to get her visualized, the facilitator was already on to some other type of meditation. So I just sat there in my aunt's visualized presence and continued to remember nice times with her. But then when we did the Vajrasattva meditation, I finally felt that fullness of the deep, eternal, true love that I had been longing all my life to feel. I felt that connection. I felt it to God. I felt one with God. I felt the safety and security of being in an environment where nothing could touch me or hurt me or use or abuse me, where I was completely understood, completely accepted, completely desired and wanted, with no reservations, no hidden agendas, no conditions, withholding nothing. And I was transformed. I was born again as the majestic Queen of Queens, ruling and reigning with my King, loving and being loved, one in purpose, one in action forever. And ladies, once you feel this true love, knowing that you are one with God and knowing what your spiritual expectation is of yourself, what your service is to God, what your service is to man, and what you will strive for as your mark of mastery, and what you wish to leave on earth as your record of victory, you will no longer need to look outside of yourself for true love. The true love of God will fill you up, and the heat of God's love will melt away the scars and heal all of your hurts. And God's love will validate you as a woman and set you on a high heel where you can then begin to survey your options. And from your position of majesty on your throne as a goddess, you can then set your boundaries, create the conditions that any prospective suitor must fulfill, and stand your ground and not settle for less. I saw the movie Maleficent this week. And boy, oh boy, ladies, you just have to go see this movie. There's a scene when Maleficent is being attacked by all the king's horses and all the king's men. And she just stands there and faces the onslaught, and she says, "Stand with me." And the entire earth raises up in various forms and creatures of immense power. And together, Maleficent and her kingdom withstands this attack, and they are untouchable, invincible, victorious. And that's how I feel, and that's how you should feel. And however you know, can know that you are one with God and you are loved by God, do it. Perhaps there is some spiritual retreat you can attend. I recommend Hindu or Buddhist retreats because they acknowledge the divine feminine, because Catholic or Christian retreats are going to continue to keep you a second-class citizen. And you're not. You're a goddess. You are the queen of queens. You are untouchable and invincible. So I suggest retreats that honor the divine feminine, because you're the best and you deserve the best, and don't settle for less. Don't settle. Set your boundaries. Make your list. There are worksheets in my book that you can begin to set your boundaries and make your list for your perfect life partner. And there will also be worksheets that can help you develop your own personal theology and your own philosophy of life. And these worksheets will clarify and help you to know what you really want in your life and what you will then want to teach to your children. So the purpose of tonight's program is to allow you to find true love within yourself first. Be filled with that love from God and for yourself. And then you will be ready to find Mr. Right. Because knowing true love first will create a magnetic force field that will attract Mr. Right right to you.
Thanks for listening to The Finding Mr. Right Show with your host, Marcy Ann. You can purchase Marcy Ann's book at www.MrRightForMe.com or reach Marcy Ann at www.MarcyAnn.com. And please join us every Friday at 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time for more ways to Finding Mr. Right.